Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. The extent of sovereignty for Native American tribes has long been like a tug of war between tribal and non-tribal governments in the U.S. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports that the issue of sovereignty trickles down to everything, even the issuance of traffic tickets. And lawmakers are moving nowhere fast to fix problems caused by disagreements over self-government for tribes.
An Indian reservation is like a sovereign nation. There isn't a separate currency. However, there is, for example, a separate police force, court system, and government. But these sovereign nations are inevitably floating in U.S. territory. It's like if Kansas was its own country. The disagreements over the extent of sovereignty for tribes has established a weird limbo, which leads to existential as well as logistical issues. For example, if a non-Indian does something bad on the Wind River Indian Reservation in Fremont County, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs cops arrive at the scene, what happens?
You ask, are you Native American? Are you of Native American descent? Do you use Indian health? Any of those things that can show that they are a descendant of a recognized tribe in the United States, then we can act and we have jurisdiction.
That's Gilbert Peck, a former BIA police officer on Wind River. He says in that situation, the non-natives can say, see ya. That's why he wanted the law changed. He says that dynamic is dangerous for both the officers and victims of crimes perpetrated by non-natives on the reservation. It's also inefficient if Fremont County cops have to get involved and come to the scene. The easiest place to start was with the most common violations, traffic.
Just didn't sit right because Native Americans could be issued citations. They would be compelled to go to court. If they didn't, a warrant was issued for them. The exact same violator who was non-Native, basically a free pass.
The legislature's interim judiciary committee agreed that something should be changed. But when a newly appointed committee took over, they decided not to debate the bill. Peck says the opposition to the bill was disappointing.
The rhetoric that amped up was the same old stuff. Is what do we do when the Native American officer goes out of control? I mean, things you'd wrinkle your face like, really? You had to ask them like that? These are professional police officers. They will handle it like they always have everything else.
However, a bill that assures liability protection for state and county officers when they enforce laws on the reservation did pass this session. Basically, lawmakers agreed to provide immunity to peace officers acting upon natives, but not the other way around. Expanding law enforcement and authority on the reservation in other areas hasn't been easy either. For example, the U.S. Congress recently passed the Violence Against Women Act, which gives tribal courts the ability to prosecute non-Native people accused of committing crimes against Native women on tribal land. All three of Wyoming's congressional delegates voted against it. Here's Representative Cynthia Lummis.
I hate doing that, especially being Wyoming's lone congressional representative who's a woman. But given the constitutional infirmities and the concerns that we heard from Wyoming law enforcement officials and members of the Wyoming Bar, I was sufficiently concerned to believe that this bill actually needed to be vetted a little more.
Chief Judge of the Shoshone and Arapaho Tribal Court, John St. Clair, is frustrated by this.
Our congressional delegation is more concerned with the rights of people who are alleged to have committed violence against our people instead of the rights of the Indian women, who are just as much citizens, as far as I can tell, going back to the Citizenship Act of 1924, we're just as much citizens as anyone else. So I just thought their concerns were misplaced.
He says even if the quality of tribal justice is a concern, there are checks on it. So why this resistance to expanded authority for the tribes? Why don't Wyoming's federal lawmakers want tribal authorities sentencing non-natives? St. Clair thinks it's pretty simple.
It must be racist, because I don't see any numbers, statistics, facts to support the contention that we're violating anyone's civil rights, Indian, non-Indian, or anyone. But yet that's the grounds or the reasons why our delegation has opposed this.
On the state level, current chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, under whom Peck's traffic bill died, Keith Gingrey, said there were two reasons lawmakers didn't necessarily want tribal and BIA cops writing tickets for non-natives. The first, he said, was because people argued about where the borders of Wind River Reservation actually are. For the record, the Fremont County planner says there are clear borders, They appear on maps, and he has testified about them in court. But the second issue was whether tribes should be doing the law enforcement themselves, or if that should be a state duty.
So you would have the county sheriff essentially doing everything on the reservation. Because I think their sheriff would be more than willing to provide all the law enforcement needs they need out there.
The Wyoming Association of Sheriffs and Chiefs of Police actually supported passing the traffic bill as drafted. Executive Director of the association, Byron Odekoven, said they helped write the bill and thought the bill would actually decrease the workload for the busy law enforcement officers in the area of Wind River. The reluctance to grant tribes more authority on their reservations is not just relegated to law enforcement. Wyoming's U.S. Senator John Barrasso proposed a bill that would have made energy development on tribal lands easier for the tribes, thereby adding economic development and jobs. It failed. This year, Representative Don Young from Alaska sponsored a similar bill. During a subcommittee hearing, he lambasted the Department of Interior's lack of support for the bill.
The thing that bothers me is self-determination. Self-government. You ignored this totally. I don't see anywhere in your statement the term self-government, self-determination, or sovereign. That's what we want to happen, and that's what you should want to happen. This is wrong. We talk about it, you talk about it, and we still want to pat them on the head and give them a blanket and a side of beef. That's wrong.
Lieutenant Peck is no longer with the BIA Police Department, but he's hoping lawmakers at least continue to talk about expanding that department's jurisdiction. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
A new focus on the Wind River Reservation is getting younger people more engaged in the political process. After a lawsuit, the reservation received a seat on the Fremont County Commission, and Northern Arapaho tribal member Patrick Goggles has been in the House of Representatives for 9 years. Goggles says it is important to develop the next round of leaders.
I had done it before previously with the late Eddie Wada, and we had talked about the next person that would be attempting to represent the House District 33. Unfortunately, Eddie, passed away. But we continue to do that. There's a group on the reservation that assisted myself with this last election. It's called Native Vote. And those folks had a number of young people helping them canvass the housing areas, the housing subdivisions. And that was the Wind River Youth Group. And so informally, not formally, but informally, we are in that process of encouraging many young folks to endeavor into the arena of politics. Our motto is that if you don't articulate the politics of your community, someone will for you.
There have been a couple of issues over the years that I've done stories on, for instance, getting people to participate in the census. And I'm always curious also about voting. Are you seeing improvements in both of those areas?
I believe that's a work in progress with the two business councils. Tribal governments have a lot of influence in getting the vote out, so to speak, within their respective communities and their constituencies. But they can have a positive impact on the number of voters that turn out. We are a microcosm of the state of Wyoming. You know, when it's a presidential election, you'll have more voters, obviously, than off your elections. And so the Native Vote folks, the Young People Vote group, the Wind River group, the two business councils have a positive influence on voter turnout.
Representative Patrick Goggles visiting with us. We've been doing some stories recently on some of the young people who have come through the university, have returned back to the reservation and are teaching or doing whatever they're doing there. Getting some of those younger people, the educated good folks back on the community, are those the kind of people maybe you're targeting, and will they play a role in some of the future political issues out there?
I would say yes. Obviously, because of their educational backgrounds, and yes, because they have come to work back on the reservation, have some positions of supervisory positions, managerial positions, even program directors. But even more than that, the workers that are the backbone of the Wind River Reservation, getting many of those folks on board with voting and consistently voting, but then also getting those folks that are sort of looking in, wanting to get into the process, maybe our college students, maybe their military, maybe their young, you know, up-and-coming parents, that group. And then there's sort of a group out there that they're still in transition, trying to decide, you know, what type of living they're going to make, getting that group as well. But like I say, it takes organization. The Native Vote Group displayed some good organizational skills this last election, using election techniques to get the vote out.
One last question for you, and we'll let you go. You know, as we all know, there was quite a little court battle on the county commissioner issue out there.
Sure.
But now that that issue is resolved and you can get people running for office and getting a seat on that, which can sometimes be a very interesting county commission, how has that helped in at least people understanding what maybe some of the issues are on the reservation?
Well, to me, that's a bridge. That's a bridge that gaps the cultural differences in Fremont County between the Native and non-Native, the city and the rural, and people of different political affiliations. That particular court case provided a bridge for Native people to cross over to what we call a bicultural world. And it provides, like I look at it, the representation of the individual rather than of a group, and that individual is represented before maybe tribe or before maybe community, that one individual has that representation that they can vote for. So it's a bridge to me, and it's a step in a direction that's positive for the residents of the Wind River Indian Reservation. And as you know, not all the people that reside on the reservation are Native. There are many non-tribal members and non-Natives that reside on the reservation that own fee property, that are taxpayers, and they need to be represented as well.
State Representative Patrick Goggles, always nice chatting with you. Thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely.
When we come back, we'll hear about what makes it hard to deliver a good financial audit for the Northern Arapaho Tribe. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The Northern Arapaho Tribe opened the doors to its full-scale casino in 2005. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhurov reports that 8 years into the venture, the casino is making money, but some wonder where it's going.
The Wind River Casino has been open for almost a decade, but it's still a novelty to walk into, wearing slot machines, dimmed lights, card tables, all on the edge of Riverton on a piece of prairie. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which established a regulatory structure for Native American gaming, was enacted in 1988, but a decade after that, Wyoming lawmakers still thought that gambling had no place in the state. The Northern Arapaho Tribe thought different and fought the state in court for the right to build a casino with the full gamut of gaming. It took 10 years, but when they won big. Andrew Baldwin represented the tribe in court.
The Northern Arapaho Tribe is the only tribe to be operating Class 3 gaming without a tribal state compact. One of the things that's different about that is there's no funding or no payment going from the tribe to the state. Most tribal state compacts have a provision where the tribe is paying the state some percentage of their revenues every year. So the Arapaho Tribe's not making that payment.
With no compact in place and business booming, the tribe should have more money to use as it deems necessary. But there is a broad set of rules about what casino money can be used for.
The federal statute, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, and regulations, and the tribe's own gaming code requires that gaming revenues be spent to fund tribal government operations or programs, or to provide for the general welfare of the tribe, or to promote the tribe's economic development, to donate to charitable organizations, or to help fund operations of local governments.
That was the whole point of Indian-run casinos, to create a revenue stream for tribes. So has the casino accomplished that goal for the Arapahoes? That depends on who you ask. The casino CEO, Jim Conrad, says the casino has been an emphatic success.
The biggest thing is the jobs that are available for tribal members and for others, but you know, mostly for the tribal members, because they really haven't had opportunities. Right now, we're around 700, and around short of 600 of all of our employees are Native American.
For several years after the casino's opening, the unemployment rates in Fremont County were notably lower than they had been for the 5 years before its opening. But it's not clear how much of that was the casino. That lasted until the recession hit in 2009. According to Conrad, the starting wage is around $8.50 per hour, and the average wage is around $11 per hour. But Conrad says that in addition to the wages, these jobs provide opportunities that did not exist before. Jobs for tribal members who have had trouble finding work, job training, and experience and confidence so that people can go on to find even better, higher-paying jobs. But other tribal members say the casino should be delivering more. Cindy Washakie, who used to run the Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC program, says low-wage jobs don't exactly fix anything.
The casino jobs, their wages are below income guidelines because the young families would be eligible for WIC, which goes on a poverty level income guidelines. So that would mean if they're eligible for WIC, then they'd be eligible for food stamps. So they're, you know, working, but they're barely making hardly any money to qualify for that.
Another tribal program employee, Zola Kilzontap, says she hasn't seen much good stemming from the casino either.
I have children that are enrolled in different tribes, and they're getting dividends. And their casino has started how many years later than ours did? They're already reaping the benefits from their casino that we, the Arapaho people should have seen way before.
But Conrad, the CEO, says that's an unfair analysis. He says the naysayers are comparing the Wind River Casino to much bigger operations in much more populated places like California. According to Conrad, those casinos make in 2 or 3 days what the Wind River makes in a month. What's more, since the casino revenues are supposed to be used for the betterment of the tribe, the casino profits are used to balance the books for some of the struggling businesses the tribe runs.
A lot of the reason they're struggling is because we're providing a service. Some of the elders tell me that they remember the day when you couldn't even get a cup of coffee on the reservation. There was nothing for them. And now they have a laundromat, so they don't have to travel to, you know, Riverton or Lander, grocery store. So, there's a lot of things we do on the res where, you know, we know going in we're not going to be able to make money.
While Conrad may be correct, Washakie says it's hard to know when tribal members are kept in the dark about the finances. She says the tribal government, known as the Business Council, who handle the casino's money, are not transparent enough. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
The Northern Arapaho tribe is a mess financially. They're behind on their audits. Past audits have not been flattering, and change has been slow to come. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov has been looking into why the audits are less than ideal and the status of the tribe's future financial solvency. She joins us now. So to start with, why is a federal governmental agency even auditing the tribe if the tribe is supposed to be sovereign?
The audits are what's called an OMB A-133 audit, which any contractor that receives over $500,000 from the federal government has to do. That applies to local governments, nonprofits, or, as in this case, tribes. The Northern Arapaho tribes get significantly more than $500,000 annually from the federal government for different programs, so they have to submit annual audits, which are actually performed by an independent firm.
So what have the audits been revealing?
Well, in 2009, the tribe scored pretty poor marks on its audit. It revealed that there were very few internal financial controls or reporting. There were no procedures in place for timely drawdowns of federal funds. Basically, there's tribal money, and then there's federal money for specific projects, and those two pots were mixing. Funds given for specific programs and projects were being used to cover costs of unrelated programs and things like tribal payroll. The auditors found that pay rates for tribal employees were disproportionate to the work being performed. There's just no system to determine wages, no method for evaluating program managers or program results. Employees were getting loans and advances, and there were no policies in place to make sure loans were authorized, that there was even money available to make the loans, and no way to track when money would be repaid. Tribal employees were not following travel reimbursement procedures. So like normally you travel for work, you provide your receipts, and then you get reimbursed. I was told that instead some people were just getting checks for large quantities of money ahead of any supposed travel. I saw at least once a check made out to a council member in April of 2012. It was for $1,200 for mileage in July, which was obviously months away. So I don't know just how prevalent that was, but like I said, I saw at least one check like that. Further, there was no formal process to assess or manage financial risks for the tribe, no internal control system to put together coherent financial reports. The audit also said that what internal policies did exist were at times circumvented internally.
Wow. So do you have any numbers for what that lack of organization is actually costing the tribe?
Well, no, not really. The financial mess kind of precludes that as well. In terms of cash management, at the end of 2009, there was a difference of $430,000 between bank statements and balance sheets. But according to the audit, in some instances, there was so little documentation that the auditor could not even estimate how many of the tribe's expenditures were legitimate or questionable. The 2010 audit, which was recently completed in April, actually, was disclaimed. That's an accounting term that basically means the records and documentation were in such poor condition that the auditor could not even perform the audit. And that's the lowest level of an auditor's report.
Why is this happening, and why is it happening consistently?
That's a really hard question to answer, and you can point the finger in a lot of different directions. Certainly one responsible entity is the tribe's government, called the Business Council. They're responsible for managing the tribe's money and making sure the various financial departments are functioning properly. So it really depends on who's sitting on the council, how well that money management is at the time, or at least to some extent. For example, the firm that did the 2009 audit said in a letter to the tribe that the skills of the people involved in preparing the tribe for the 2009 audit have deteriorated since the 2008 audit. That same letter also said that there's been a number of changes in key accounting staff and consultants, and the new people were not meeting deadlines and not providing the proper documents. But it's not just the top tier of tribal leaders. Like I said before, one of the audit findings was that a lot of people working for the tribe aren't necessarily qualified in terms of skills to do the job they're hired to do. Another issue is, even if the employees are qualified, sometimes they're just not showing up to work. The audit said that numerous employees either do not show up for work or do not perform any measurable benefit when they are at work. This is obviously anecdotal, but just from my time reporting on the reservation, I've had pretty limited luck in reaching people at their offices. I mean, I've been researching this story for months. In fact, the Business Council has switched during this time, and I've never once been able to reach a single council member during either term. But, you know, to be fair, the new council is, well, new, and they are responding to my inquiries, albeit indirectly. The chief financial officer for the tribe is another example. I've called him what seems like 100 times and never reached him. And at times his voicemail was full, which tells me I wasn't the only one unable to reach him. Of course, it's possible they're avoiding me as well, which I guess I don't really blame them for.
Well, maybe. But really, why do you say that?
Well, because while the Business Council is the most obvious entity to blame here, they're not alone. The way the federal government awards money to tribes is through what's called 638 contracts. The feds give the money and leave the administration to the tribes. Well, that's really great because then the tribes can administer those programs how they see fit without the government meddling. What's not so great is it's a relatively new approach, started in the 70s, and the feds provide limited training. I think it's fair to say that some tribes are missing kind of the bureaucratic culture necessary to administer the contracts, and the feds are not providing adequate training.
And so then is the federal government then coming back after seeing these bad audits and then punishing the tribe somehow?
Yeah. That letter from the auditing firm outlined the risk that the tribe could face for both its failure to turn in audits on time as well as for the poor contents of the audits. The auditor thought that the federal government might limit or reduce future grant amounts. That's a big deal because, remember, most of the money is going towards health and human services. There were other letters from, for example, Indian Health Services threatening discontinuation of certain contracts. The auditor also thought that American Recovery and Reinvestment Act money would be denied and they might demand some funds to be returned. and their programs could be put on a reimbursement-only basis. Right now, according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the tribe is on sanctions for non-submission of their more recent audits. The BIA is imposing monthly payments of monies instead of providing automatic lump payments. There are other non-governmental related risks as well, like banks not willing to fund projects due to these negative financial statements. The auditor was particularly concerned about the loan the tribe took out to build the casino and a possible increase in the interest rate on that loan due to a technical default caused by late audits.
So is the tribe responding in any way?
Yeah, they are. After the 2009 audit, there was a corrective action plan that was developed by the council. I don't know for sure how much of that plan has been put in place and how successful it's been, but I know that at least some of its proposals have been instituted. And I mentioned earlier that there has been a council change. The new council took office in January, so they're new on the job. So far, they're reluctant to talk, but they did issue a statement acknowledging the audits and the poor documentation that led to those bad marks. They said the management issues and findings were many years in the making and will take time and considerable financial resources to fix. They said they've made several changes already in additions to software and the IT structure. And they're undergoing a top-to-bottom review of all programs, tribal and federal, to determine if either improper spending is taking place and if personnel changes are required. Further, they said they're committed to cleaning up the tribe's mismanagement issues that have been longstanding. So it sounds like they are working to address the many issues we talked about, but only time will tell how successful they are. I know at least one council member has a background in accounting, which should hopefully help in this endeavor.
Well, I mean, Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff, thank you so much for that report.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll have a story on difficulties Native Americans have adapting to the University of Wyoming, an interview with the Arapaho School District superintendents, and a new mentorship program. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. In the mid-1990s, the University of Wyoming made a conscious effort to attract more Native American students to the university. Over the years, recruitment and retention of students from the Wind River Reservation has been challenging. New efforts could change things, and many believe that will be important for the long-term health of the reservation. Tanea Moon Morris was a UW Native American student around the time when the program first got cranked up. She is now the UW Assistant Director of Admissions, who is also the Multicultural Recruitment Coordinator. Morris says it is a challenge to bring and retain Native students, both because of cultural issues and due to policies at the university. For instance, some neighboring colleges and universities offer more tuition breaks and other incentives for Native students than UW.
Fort Lewis College in Colorado, if you're an enrolled member of a tribe, free tuition and fees. Utah, there's housing options for Native students. So some of our competitors, they have a lot more to offer Native students than what we are offering.
Morris says another thing she wants to focus on is personal communication and building relationships with people on the reservation. That message has been fed to the university administration, and they are moving forward to solve it. Vice President of Student Affairs Sarah Axelson agrees that constant communication seems to make a difference to Native students. Morris also convinced her to add a direct Native American contact for students, who Axelson says will start soon.
We have a full-time counselor and with a graduate assistant helping to support our Native students. And I think it will really do a lot in terms of just the coordination and the point of contact. You know, it's just easier from a communication standpoint.
Morris says all of this should make a tremendous difference. Here's something you should understand. That transition from the reservation to a university without a lot of Native support services can be a little daunting, and sometimes it leads to dropping out. But she quickly adds, do not underestimate their interest in education.
You will not find communities more driven to education than the Native communities. Our history has deemed that really the only thing that can't be taken away from us is what we know.
Amanda LeClaire agrees. She is a kindergarten aide at Fort Washakie School after receiving both her undergrad and master's degrees from the University of Wyoming. She says tribal leaders made it clear that they want young people to get degrees and possibly return to the reservation with that knowledge.
Yeah, that was something I heard in my life, definitely, especially in STEM programs like science and engineering. and everything, that there's a really big need for that out here.
LeClaire did return and now says that she believes part of her responsibility in the school system is to set an example so that the children she deals with also aspire to go to college.
That's a huge thing when you see someone from your community who you admire or who you're related to or whoever that goes away, gets their degree and comes back, and you see that and you see them working in a job and that, you know, they went away from home and it was okay.
Jordan Dresser works in marketing for the Wind River Hotel and Casino after getting his degree from UW in journalism. For him, what made coming to UW difficult was the lack of a large Native American population in Laramie.
You're coming from the reservation where everybody's like you. You know, you're all Native, so you have that all in common. But then you go to a place where you're the minority, and I think that's very difficult. And I think it's hard to describe, especially to non-Native people, you know, because I think they think, well, you know, everybody, all the other students are leaving home too. You know, it's just that difficult. But I think it's just different for Native students.
Dresser, though, was able to find a group of Native American students to bond with and also was blessed to find some Native American journalism mentors to help him with his craft. Because of that support, he felt obligated to succeed. But the conflict came after he graduated, when he had to decide whether to work at a newspaper or return to the Wind River Reservation and help the Northern Arapaho tribe. He decided to return.
I knew that in order to settle it, I had to come home and see what I could try to do, rather than just leave with it, say, well, thank you, tribe, thank you, Northern Arapaho tribe, for giving me this opportunity, but now I'm going to go live my dream.
Now he's doing his own mentoring, and he says with more young people getting degrees and returning to Wind River, it is making a difference. Back at the University of Wyoming, Tanaya Moon Morris has also noted the difference and is looking at innovative ways to help Wind River Reservation students get their degrees. Since the first 2 years away from the reservation seem to be the most difficult, she's trying to bridge things for some students by encouraging them to attend Central Wyoming College.
They're still close to home. They start at CWC. They do quite well. They're able to establish their footing in a higher ed system. And then it's not such a big jump to take them from CWC to UW.
Morris says she is very optimistic that all of these efforts will pay off. Once faltering Fremont County School District 38 in Arapaho turned a complete 180 since Superintendent Jonathan Brock took the helm in January of 2012. Last fall, the Arapaho School met No Child Left Behind's requirements for annual yearly progress for the first time under the Safe Harbor program, and frequent local assessments have shown steady improvement in math and reading. District 38 serves primarily Northern Arapaho students with high rates of poverty, but Brock says poverty has little to do with the efficacy of education. He says aligning the curriculum and frequently and consistently testing the students has made a difference. In December, Brock announced he would be leaving Fremont 38 at the end of the school year. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez spoke with Brock this spring in the Arapaho School cafeteria as students finished their breakfast.
After prying him away from the students and teachers who stopped to greet him, I asked Brock about the new developments in the school district's progress since the fall.
Well, most school districts, they do summative testing. One way we summative test is we'll do what's called universal screening at the beginning of the year, middle of the school year, and we'll do it at the end of the school year. Well, during our mid-year benchmark testing that we did in February, we were able to see that according to our maps, our measure of academic progress, that we had students who grew, once again, multiple months. They exceeded the average 4 or 5 months that they were here. With MAPS, we use the same measures as PAWS, below basic, basic, proficient, or advanced. Our teachers moved every single eighth grader out of below basic. There's no below basic eighth grader, and they're on their way to being proficient and advanced as a class. Other grades, we had students who You know, like I said, anywhere from 33% of the kids up to 100%, like in eighth grade, anywhere in between, just taken out of below basic, and they're moving on up skills-wise. And with AYP happening last fall, it was great news. But when you do a good turnaround model like we've done, one of the core elements in a turnaround model is you measure where you're at and you celebrate reaching goals, but then you keep moving forward for the higher goals. So we're grateful for those goals, but we have been talking all school year about this district being in the top 10 of all 48 school districts.
I asked Brock what he attributes the successes to.
I would attribute it to a number of things. It was, in essence, reculturing, if you will, the school district. Reculturing towards what are our priorities for curriculum and how do we implement them? What are our priorities for teachers meeting and discussing what they do, their practices? When you have a group of teachers in a homogeneous grade or department discussing the same assessments and the same students and the same curriculum, automatically great things start to happen.
Brock said the school district has a positive culture where students are enthusiastic and where success seems possible and is encouraged. I asked if it had always been that way.
You know, I can only speak for the 14, 15 months that I've been here, but no, it hasn't. From what I understand, there were years where things were extremely good here, and our board members will even tell you that there were years where Fremont 38 was one of the highest performing districts in Wyoming. And then just over time, it just went downhill. But again, it all goes back to leadership. Whether it's me or another man or woman, who the principals are, who the teachers are, and what they embrace.
Is it expectations or leading by example? What is it?
It's both. It's both. We have not varied hardly at all from what we said we were going to start doing 12, 13 months ago. There's been extremely little variation. And I think most adults who work here or come here would tell you the same. We were saying the same things back January, February of 2012. Here's what we're going to start doing. I've been working with my district improvement team, which consists of teachers, paraprofessionals, parents, and administrators, on what we're calling sustainability measures for the progress in the district. We need to sustain it, regardless of who's the captain of the ship.
Jonathan Brock left Fremont School District 38 on Tuesday to become superintendent of the Niobrara County School District. Assistant Superintendent Chantel Denson is now acting superintendent, and she'll take over the job officially in July. Brock says Denson is an excellent choice to fill the position. Denson says she'll do everything she can to keep the school district on the right track. What do you expect your biggest challenges to be in the next year or two?
We really want to increase our community, and we really want to increase the culture of our students, being Native American students and having their education on the reservation. We want to increase that culture identity so they're successful when they move on to their next step in education. We really want to make sure that they have a true sense of self, that they're still able to carry on their successes they experienced with us at Arapahoe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Substance abuse is a concern for most school districts across the country, but on the Wind River Indian Reservation, it's a red flag for especially high crime and suicide rates. Tribes have been trying with mixed success to keep kids from abusing alcohol and tobacco. But a new program from the Eastern Shoshone Department of Juvenile Services is working to train a league of student mentors to help their peers avoid risky behaviors. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez has more.
We have, right here we have a bottle of rat poison, and we have insecticide.
Raynette Tendor is rifling through a bag of props she uses to teach elementary and middle school kids about the contents of commercial cigarettes and what they can do to your lungs. She pulls out some squishy lung replicas. She starts out with a smooth, pink, healthy one, but she says kids always react to the lumpy, blackened, cancerous lung.
The first thing is, ew, yuck, or a lot of kids say, that's my mom's lung, or that's my dad's lung.
Tendor works for the Shoshone and Arapaho Tobacco Prevention Program, just one prevention group that's partnering with the new intertribal program called Eastern Shoshone Cross-Age Peer Education, or ESCAPE. Using federal grant funding, the Eastern Shoshone Department of Juvenile Services is developing ESCAPE to be a peer mentorship program. Students will be trained to lead presentations about certain health and social issues, and then they'll mentor younger kids. Juvenile Services Director Clarence Thomas says the tribes have tried preventive education before, but that this stands to be more effective.
And the youth are the only individuals who can totally make change with cross-age peer mentoring, meaning a 12th grader can go down to a 5th grader, a 5th grader can go down to a kindergartner. We can start seeing a positive movement, positive change.
ESCAPE is recruiting 11 to 18-year-olds to learn about drug and bullying prevention, the dangers of alcohol, and the importance of good nutrition. Tribal elders and organizations, including public health, suicide, and sexual assault prevention programs, are meeting with them for regular trainings.
Chief Swag.
The Department of Juvenile Services began drumming up interest among students at a huge ESCAPE kickoff party this school year. National speakers talked about avoiding substance abuse and the importance of tribal identity. Rapper Chief Swag, a member of the Aquinnah Wampanoag tribe, performed at the kickoff.
I'm powwow craving, I ain't been in a month. Dreaming about Indian tacos, meat pies and stuff. Might meet a lady if I got lady luck. I'm an eagle feather, you're the feather of a duck.
Celebrating tribal identity is a huge part of ESCAPE's mission to encourage kids to make healthy choices. Jay Old Coyote, who works with Raynette Tendor in the smoking prevention program, says a lot of unhealthy habits on the reservation are justified by perverse traditionalism or a distortion of Indian traditions.
Or a lot of Native Americans say, just because I'm Native American, I'm obligated to smoke. So we're trying to change their minds on how to respect tobacco.
Old Coyote says he and the student mentors he trains will be teaching students about the differences between natural tobacco and commercial cigarettes and where tobacco fits in with tribal heritage.
Back in the early stages of Native American history, tobacco was one of the main ingredients on how to communicate with the Creator. And, you know, it was a sign of peace.
Alcohol and drugs are a huge concern on the reservation. According to the most recent Wyoming Prevention Needs Assessment, 20% of high school seniors on the Wind River Reservation said they'd been to 6 to 9 events with large amounts of alcohol in the past year. 18% said they'd been to 10 or more. Sunny Goggles is the program coordinator for the Shoshone Arapaho Tribal Substance Abuse Court. She gathers statistics like these for area prevention programs. Goggles says she thinks mentorship will be more effective than lectures in preventing alcohol abuse in young people because they're social creatures.
People trying to work on their substance abuse issues here in the community, they struggle because they have great support to get them drunk. They have great support to use. They have great support for them to get involved in negativity.
Goggles is 36, and she says many of her peers are already dying from liver complications. And since young people make up half of the population on the Wind River Reservation, she says focusing on positively empowering students is just a good use of resources. 17-year-old Latia Tendor is training to be an ESCAPE mentor. She shares a lot of the same concerns.
I've seen kids get drunk. They start fighting, and they start saying stuff to people that they love dearly. And if, like, they smoke, they're going to go home and take it back to their siblings, and then their siblings are going to grow up because everybody knows that little kids want to be just like you.
Latia has positive role models in her life, including her auntie Raynette, who works for the smoking prevention program. But Latia understands what a lot of her peers are going through. She says kids confide in her with their problems already, even when she doesn't ask. 37 students have begun ESCAPE mentor training. They'll begin leading presentations and working with kids in the fall. Educators say they're excited to see what a peer-focused program can offer and hope it will be an effective tool in the prevention toolbox. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
Working hard every day cause I got a dream. I'm Native and I'm young, so they out to get me. I'm a warrior, so I don't know defeat. Cheap swag hot like a trillion degrees. Ask any Indian, everybody know me. Everywhere I go, I got some natives next to me. The world wanna see natives down 6 feet. I tell them hell no, I'll be at the TOP. and I'm bringing all my native people with me. Every time I rap, I feel like I give a speech. Don't mess with drugs, alcohol, or the tree. We must save our people, we cannot die here. So thank you, killer ending, every time you crack a beer. If we don't act now, the end is near. We must make a difference, it's stand-up time. My blood was here first, so the world is mine. Chief Swag, baby, yeah, I'm known to shine.
When we come back, we'll have an essay from a UW graduate about his family's relationship with the Shoshone tribe. This is Open Spaces.
She say I'm interesting and very different. She had so much fun, so she cried when I left. Keep it so official, so she called me Ref Jeff. It's an understatement to say that I'm the best. Haters keep hating, but she won't stop me. Chief Swag, baby, yeah, I keep it OG. Everywhere I go, I got people next to me trying to get my face.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Kit Friedman is a graduate of the University of Wyoming who did his thesis research on the Wind River Indian Reservation. In this essay, he reflects on his family's multi-generational history in Lander.
The first record of my family in Wyoming dates back to 1867, before Wyoming was a state. That year, my great-great-grandfather, E.F. Cheney, arrived at Camp Carlin near present-day Cheyenne. Following a short-lived attempt at homesteading, he moved further west to Atlantic City. Gold had been discovered on South Pass. Though he never struck it rich, Cheney fell in love, married, and in 1878, he and his young wife relocated to Lander, where my family has remained ever since. They raised four children and eventually settled on a cattle ranch off the lower North Fork of the Popoja River. It was here that Cheney is said to have become friendly with the Shoshone Indians. He provided beef cattle to the Shoshone Agency and ultimately befriended the already legendary leader of the Eastern Shoshone tribe, Chief Washakie. Most of what I know of my family's history and their relationship with the Shoshone people, I learned from my grandmother, Cheney's granddaughter. As a kid, I'd spend hours listening to her recall story after story in between drags of her more 120 extra-long cigarettes. Stories of visits from Chief Washakie to the Cheney home, or how her mother had learned to, quote, speak Indian before she spoke English, how she was raised wearing moccasins, or about how when Chief Washakie died in 1900, my great-great-grandfather served as an honorary pallbearer at his funeral. My grandmother was a wonderful woman, and someone I looked up to very much. Witty and clever, her stories, no matter how far afield, always contained a simple lesson. Be a good person. She was very much an idealist, and perhaps it was her own idealism that led her to become a social worker on the reservation. People she worked with often told me she was a good lady, that she was known as Grandma to many on the reservation. Before she died, the Shoshone tribe held a ceremony in honor of her life's work, and when she finally passed in 2008, her funeral was presided over by Chief Washakie's great-great-grandson, the Sundance chief and medicine man of the Eastern Shoshone tribe. I do not take my family's history to mean I know something more about or to have a privileged relationship with the people and families on the reservation. While I'm certainly proud knowing my family's long history with the Shoshone people, if anything, my knowledge of this history has afforded me a deep respect and appreciation for a way of life different than my own. Perhaps it was this appreciation, then, that led me to the reservation for my own work. I researched the impacts of a Cold War uranium mill for my master's thesis in anthropology and environment natural resources at the University of Wyoming. Provided the history of research and the legacy of anthropologists on reservations, it came as no surprise when I was met with some level of hostility and suspicion regarding my motivations for carrying out the project. Despite my best intentions, I was quickly labeled a spy, a researcher, and perhaps worse, an anthropologist. Although I eventually developed, dare I say, trusting relationships with the people I was working with on the reservation, I never mentioned my grandmother. Then, in one of my final interviews for the project, I asked simply out of curiosity if the person I was interviewing ever knew Betty Friedman. "Betty Friedman," he grumbled. "Betty Friedman, ah yes, she's a white witch, that white devil woman who came out here and took all our children out of their homes and put them with white foster families. Yeah, I know her. She was out here, stealing children, doing the white man's work, taking children out of Indian homes and giving them away." I was floored. I'd never heard a bad word said about my grandmother. I didn't say anything. All I could do was listen as this person recounted the horrors and atrocities my grandmother had apparently committed. The whole experience was confronting, to say the least. This woman, who I had held in such high regard, who had inspired me so much growing up, and who instilled in me a deep respect for Native American culture, being denigrated for the very thing I had always assumed she was fighting against. I later followed up with a woman who had worked with my grandmother on the reservation. Yes, she had taken children from homes, and yes, she had made some people very mad. But that was rare. She told me it was something my grandmother had struggled with. Later, I learned my grandmother battled for a time with alcoholism, no doubt related to her occupation on the reservation. I'm Kip Friedman.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of Open Spaces. Next week, we'll return with a brand new program. If you have topics or ideas for the show, you can drop them to us online via wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces, or you can contact News Director Bob Beck. You can follow all of our reporters on Twitter. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.